Yes, this is Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge. And just stay tuned as we're coming up to Evening Under Lamplight. As you all may know, we're waiting for the beeps, and the beeps will announce the start of the new next hour's show, starting in just a very few seconds. So are you ready? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. This is our new format of coming to you every fourth week rather than every second week. So it's been a while since we were last together. It was good to sit down again and plan a new show, as I hope it will be equally good for you to sit down and attend to a new show with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge. The email address for us at the show is lamplight@cambridge105.fm, and the archives of the show can always be found at momentsunderlamplight.com. Keep in touch. It's time for our autumn show. You may recall that we had a show not that long ago about harvest anxiety and abundance, and you may recall that the Chinese system sees five seasons in a year, separating harvest, the time when we reap all that the summer has nurtured and grown, and autumn, or fall, the time when we start losing things, losing summer warmth, losing leaves on the trees, losing daylight hours. And that's where we are now, the season of loss, but also the season of beginnings. Whenever we set off on a new journey, of course we're going to lose something. We lose whatever we had before the journey. We leave these things behind. Loss doesn't have to be a time of grief for what is gone. It may call forth great courage in us and can reward us with a sharpness of vision and an eager anticipation that empowers us like a good fresh breath of air into our lungs. And these elements are all found in the Chinese autumn energy, grief, courage, lungs, and the sharpness of a metal blade. Let's take a few minutes to get into the spirit of this season with the autumn meditation from my CD, Journey Through the Seasons, the meditation that starts off the cycle of the seasons. One of my motives for creating these meditations was to bring together my interest in holistic energy and literature. Many of the healers I knew were very sensitive, warm people, full of insight and receptivity, but they seemed to have no knowledge of the great poems and stories that I have read and taught and loved all my life, and that, read attentively, can give us deeper insight into the holistic spirit of the world. And many, or most, of the people I knew in the world of literature had very little time for holistic anything or spiritual anything. It was intellectual analysis pretty much all the time. Could I, then, bridge these two groups and use some great poems to bring to life some of the great energy patterns of the world? That's the challenge I set myself. To tell the truth, I'm happy with the result, but what matters is whether you are happy. In any case, here's the meditation, which features readings from the Ecclesiastes poet and lines from The Tempest and King Lear, from the Book of Matthew, Shakespeare's Sonnet 73, and Shelley's Ode on the West Wind. The music is by Neil Henry. Autumn. In the midst of our journey into deeper life, we find ourselves now at the time of cleansing, purification, the time when we lose everything that is not essential, as we prepare to enter the darkness of our true selves. This is the time of autumn, the time of dryness, when leaves fall from the trees, hedges turn brown, stubble in the fields is plowed under. This is a melancholy season of loss, as the afternoons grow darker and daylight diminishes, and the summer warmth fades to a dim memory. It is the time of growing old. We are in the autumn of our lives when we lose our hair and our teeth, our senses grow dull, our vigor wanes. It is time to start thinking about death. Every third thought shall be my grave. We have not chosen to take this journey. The journey calls us, or God calls us. I have a journey, sir, shortly to go. My master calls me, I must not say no. No more pretense. We must cut away so only our essential selves remain. The weight of this sad time we must obey. Speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. We cast off all vain things to prepare for the time of emptiness, when the dust shall return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. The element associated with this season is metal. Cold, hard, unrelenting, like the biting wind cutting through our clothes and stinging our face. Here is the axe, pruning dead wood, cutting away what is not essential. This is the season of Advent, the time of year for meditating on the one who comes as the axe to cut back the old and no longer useful parts. And now also the axe is laid unto the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. The organ associated with autumn is the lungs, enacting the seasonal loss on a small scale every time we breathe out, each exhaling a mini death, expiring, exhausted, used up, empty, but only temporary, only part of a cycle of in and out, dying and being reborn, like the larger cycle of the seasons. The negative emotion associated with this stage of the journey is sadness, or grief, especially grief over things lost, the loss of leaves falling from the trees, the departure of friends and lovers, and most of all, the passing of time. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. If we face grief long enough, we may reach to the positive emotion for this season, courage. The courage to keep moving on our journey despite loss and grief. And the courage to surrender, to let go. Dust and ashes, we hold them up in our open palm and let the wind take them away. Let them go. We can be willing even to let go our own identity and become an instrument played on by the wind, letting go, completely abandoned to the forces of nature working upon us, transformed into a melodious, though sad, wind chime. Or we become a harp or lyre, our strings vibrating like the trees swaying and rustling in the wind. Make me thy lyre, we ask of the strong autumn west wind. Make me thy lyre, even as the forest is. What if my leaves are falling like its own? The tumult of thy mighty harmonies will take from both a deep autumnal tone, sweet though in sadness. Once we embrace this loss at whatever level, the sadness becomes sweet, even though it leads us to winter and death. We know, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? That was the Meditation on Autumn, from Journey Through the Seasons, Meditations on the Five Chinese Healing Energies. You can find out more by going to journeythroughtheseasons.com. There's a direct link at the top of the momentsunderlamplight.com site. And how are we going to develop our evening together with this autumn energy? Here's what I propose. Autumn is the starting point of the cyclical journey, and let's spend some time thinking about the mythic images of departure. I often teach Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, an incisive and enlightening book, though not always an easy book to fathom. The book proposes that most mythic stories take the pattern of what Campbell calls the monomyth, the great archetypal story in which the hero-to-be goes on, or undergoes, a transformative journey that takes this hero beyond the ego into unity with some larger pattern or energy in the universe, enabling the hero to serve others. The hero starts the journey in the wasteland, that ordinary world we all know so well, a place of routine and clashing egos and discontent and impotent longing. The wasteland is controlled by holdfast, that person or that power that holds fast to things as they are. Holdfast is afraid of loss, afraid of the grief that comes from loss, and perhaps afraid of the unknown. If I lose what I know, even though it is far from ideal, if I lose what I know, then where will I be? My ego clings to what it knows and what it has some hope of controlling. Better the wasteland I know than the journey that is bound to shake me up and hurt me in some way. I have three songs to start us off, three songs about different aspects of the wasteland. The first person who came to my mind was Frank Zappa, such a fierce opponent of that wasteland of the Southern California that he grew up in, the culture of conformity and inner emptiness, or plasticity, as he called it. It's from the Mothers of Invention album, Absolutely Free. The song starts with an announcement from the President of the United States, who has been sick. This refers, I suppose, to the time when Lyndon Johnson came back from a gallbladder operation and pulled up his shirt on television to show the whole country his scar. Only in a wasteland would the leader of the country be quite so crass. And, of course, he pulled this stunt in order to deflect the public from his policies, especially his deepening engagement in Vietnam, which was highly unpopular. Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag. And then the CIA creeping around, and the fine little girl, as plastic as she can be, who paints her face with plastic goo and wrecks her hair with some shampoo. Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag. Take a day and walk around, watch the Nazis run your town, then go home and check yourself. You think we're talking about someone else. But you're plastic people. Oh, baby, now you're such a drag. And the conclusion? I'm sure that love will never be a product of plasticity. But the words convey only a part of the effect. Attend to the full performance, and don't miss the presence of Louie Louie, the song that for Zappa stood for all the idiocy of popular teen music.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
He's been sick. And I think his wife is going to bring him some chicken soup.
Plastic people, oh baby, not such a drag.
I know it's hard to defend an unpopular policy every once in a while.
Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag.
And there's this guy from the CIA and he's creeping around Laurel Canyon.
Fine little girl, she waits for me. She's as plastic as she can be. She paints her face with plastic goo and wrecks her hair with some shampoo.
Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag.
I don't know, sometimes I just get tired of you, honey. It's that's your hairspray or something.
Plastic people, oh baby, you're such a drag.
I hear the sound of marching feet down Sunset Boulevard to Crescent Heights, and there at Pandora's Box, we are confronted with a vast quantity of plastic people.
Take a day and walk around. Watch the Nazis run your town. Then go home and check yourself. You think we're singing about someone else?
You're plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag.
A product of plasticity. A product of plasticity. A product of plasticity.
Plastic people are your foot, your hair, your nose, your arm. You eat, suck,
plastic.
You are, your being is you, plastic.
No, a prune is not a vegetable. Cabbage is a vegetable, makes it okay.
You dream about, you think only of, you read. You are pebbles, plastic, plastic pebbles.
Purple prancing.
Everybody. That was Plastic People from the Mothers of Invention album Absolutely Free. Going out especially for Axel, because I know he likes Zappa. Now that's the kind of wasteland that Holdfast wants to keep us in, either through plastic dolls with back-combed, hair-sprayed headpieces, or through force by the CIA and the Nazi police. But the wasteland is not just a place of plasticity and ugly routine. It's also a place of profound dissatisfaction, though we usually have enough things to keep us from thinking about it. Why else do we have television, video games, iPods, alcohol, etc.? It seemed to me a good time to play a song that I've avoided on Evening Under Lamplight. A little too raucous, a little too cliched, but it fits in right just here. I mean the Rolling Stones' Satisfaction. A song that came in second place in Rolling Stones' 500 Greatest Songs of All Time. Of all time, indeed. It's a song about the frustration of this wasteland of mindless information on the radio. Not this radio, of course. Stupid commercialization on the television. And girls who tell you to come back next week. It's not their fault, they're just on a losing streak. But it just goes to point out again how frustrating life in this wasteland is right now. I try and I try and I try and I try, but I can't get no satisfaction. As usual, the Rolling Stones come up with the driving, bitter, elegant music that makes the words resonate deep in us. Are you angry and frustrated? Listen loudly to early Rolling Stones hits. And look out, here comes one now!
I'm
wasteland will never give us satisfaction. If only because, while we are in this wasteland, we are in the world of the ego, and the ego can never be satisfied. It always wants more, until something sends it out on its journey to be transformed. Then it can find peace and be ready to serve others, help them find some satisfaction, rather than complain that it cannot get satisfaction. Or lastly, the wasteland can just drag us down by its stagnation. Looks like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. Hypnotized by holdfast. And what can we do? Just sit in the morning sun and still be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships come in and watching them roll away again. Otis Redding makes Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay a beautiful, haunting song, but its overriding melancholy reminds us that it, too, comes out of the wasteland.
Sittin' in the morning sun, I'll be sittin' when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay, 'cause I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time.
There it goes, whistling away. There we go, 1, 2. You're here with Evening Under Lamplight, celebrating autumnal thresholds on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge, and I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson. We've just heard, as you very well know, Otis Redding's Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay, another song about that wasteland we all sit in until we are called by the herald to go off on our adventure. An adventure that the myths portray as an outward journey and a battle against monsters, but we actually experience it ourselves, deep within ourselves, a journey to the center of our soul. Calling, the calling, can come as an open invitation, a voice from beyond somewhere calling us to come too, or it can be a direct command or instruction, like the one given to Abraham on the famous 12th chapter of Genesis, Lech Lecha, God says to Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And from that came the whole long story. Or the calling might come from a simple blunder or trick, something that can deflect us from our ego-driven attempt to control our lives so that we open up to other possibilities. All we would need would be to shift our position sitting on the dock of the bay and slip off into the water. A momentary blunder, but calling us potentially to a road of trials, painful, but in the end, perhaps deeply rewarding. If on the way, we learn to let go of our ego control. There's an important novel by Ian Crichton Smith, one of the greatest figures of 20th century Scottish literature, a Gaelic speaker who grew up on the Isle of Lewis, a novel called Consider the Lilies, about a nasty, bigoted old woman living in a rural Hebridean community, one of those righteous religious women who know what's wrong with everyone else and never stop telling them. She has alienated all the members of her family and turns the world around her into a dreadful wasteland. One day, however, as she walks along the road, she has a turn and falls into the ditch. A blunder. The next thing she knows, she's lying in a clean, comfortable bed, but to her horror, she discovers she's in the house of the notorious atheist, whom she considers God's worst enemy. But he and his family are kind to her and help her recover. That fall in the ditch was this woman's calling, and the novel portrays her inner journey of transformation out of her rigid religious negativity into the discovery of the joys of sharing in a loving community. If she hadn't fallen into that ditch, she might well have missed the calling, as she apparently had missed it many times before, in fact, every time she'd heard the gospel preached. And so we look out for these blunders, these moments of unexpected violence that disrupt our place in the wasteland and offer us this autumnal calling to leave. This reminds me of the title of Flannery O'Connor's second novel, The Violent Bear It Away, a reference to the line in Matthew that the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence and the violent bear it away. Many or perhaps most of Flannery O'Connor's stories involve some sort of violence done to the main character to call the character out of the wasteland and onto a transformative journey. Think of the grandma in the story A Good Man is Hard to Find, whose ride in the country is disrupted by the escaped convict known as the Misfit, who waylays the family. I better start talking like this now. Who waylays the family and has his two henchmen lead the wife, daughter, and infant into the woods to shoot them, and then the husband and son, leaving the self-centered grandmother alone face to face with the misfit, his gun pointed at her. Like Ian Crichton Smith's old woman, the grandmother uses religion like a weapon, and she tells the misfit to pray to Jesus. You've got good blood, she says. I know you wouldn't shoot a lady. I know you come from nice people. Pray, Jesus, you ought not to shoot a lady. I'll give you all the money I got. Lady, said the misfit, looking beyond her far into the woods, there never was a body that give the undertaker a tip. They get into a theological discussion, and the misfit admits he doesn't know if Jesus raised the dead or not, but he'd like to have been there. I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the misfit said. I wished I'd have been there, he said, hitting the ground with his fist. It ain't right that I wasn't there, because if I'd have been there, I would have known. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice, if I had have been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now. His voice seemed about to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. And this is her calling. She turns from the wasteland of her nasty religion and responds with a gesture of love. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, "Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her three times through the chest. See, this is what's known as Southern Gothic. It goes in for violence, but also mythic overtones. She dies, but has been transformed, the imagery telling us that she had achieved a childlike state of grace, looking to heaven. She half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood, with her legs crossed under her like a child's, and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. One of the misfit's idiotic sidekicks is highly amused. "She was a talker, wasn't she?" he says. But the misfit has something deeper to say. "She would have been a good woman," the misfit said, "if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life." Yes, the violent bear it away and call us out of the wasteland onto our journey. Someone once said to Flannery O'Connor that her stories left a bad taste in her mouth. "You weren't supposed to eat them," Flannery replied. No, not eat them, attend to them. But it doesn't really matter how we are called. What matters is that we accept the calling. We are free, though, to refuse it and let hold fast keep us a while longer. But don't worry, the calling will come again and again, perhaps with increasing violence, who knows? And finally, when we realize we really can't get no satisfaction in that wasteland, we will be off. Yes, we may be off, but the people remaining back in the wasteland, they most likely will have no clue about what's happened to us. "Why, he just went off like that," they'll say. Or, "I don't know what got into her, but she was gone next time I looked." This mythic perspective can give us a different view of Bob Dylan's song, "Man in the Long Black Coat." She's gone and they don't know why. Not a word of goodbye, not even a note. But we know what she's done. She's off on her journey with that man in the long black coat who has just heralded her into her hero's adventure.
Somebody said from the Bible he'd quote, there was dust on the man in the long black coat. Preacher was a talking, there's a sermon he gave. He said every man's conscience is vile and depraved. You cannot depend on it to be your guide when it's you who must keep it satisfied. It ain't easy to swallow. It sticks in the throat to give her heart to the man in a long black coat. There are no mistakes in life, some people say. It is true sometimes. You can see it that way. But people don't live or die, people just float. She went with the man in a long black coat. There's smoke on the water, it's up in there since June. Tree trunks uprooted beneath the high crescent moon. Feel the pulse and vibration and the rumbling fuss. Somebody is out there beating on a dead horse. She never said nothing, there was nothing she wrote. She'd gone with a man in a long black coat.
She's gone with the man in the long black coat. And who knows what grief accompanied her departure? Who knows what she has lost and left behind? But her autumnal energy can help her turn from grief to courage as she moves on to what's next. And she'll need courage, because before she actually begins the adventure, she has to cross over the threshold into the land where she will undergo her road of trials, a land that Joseph Campbell calls the dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. It's a place like a dream where the ego can hardly understand what is going on, where there is nothing to hold on to, where the only option, ultimately, is to submit to the higher forms moving about. This is the energy of the dark winter season, which we might look at in a few months. To cross the threshold into that sort of world requires us to be in the right frame of mind, open, courageous, and not out for ourselves. And so the hero invariably meets the guardian at the gates, some figure, some monster, or some crisis that can look so impossible that we are tempted to give up and turn back. It's a challenge, a test, to see if we're ready to cross over. Here's a song that I think depicts such a moment. It's good to have some sort of psychedelic song to represent this eerie moment, and I fished around in Country Joe and the Fish albums to discover that the song Magoo, which can be taken as a love song asking his girlfriend to stay as she is, as a comfort to him in a frightening world, can also show us this moment of testing. He gets a vision of the enormity of the universe. The stars are so big, and the earth so small, and he shrinks away. Stay as you are, he sings, and behind him comes the chant, life before death. All very well if this is an anti-Vietnam song, but in the mythic realm we must advance courageously towards death, the death of our ego, and we must refuse to stay as we are. The thunderous waves crashing over him here, and as I see it, they defeat him. Poor hippie boy turns around and refuses the adventure.
Sometimes when I look into your eyes. The hurt and pain I see makes me want to cry. The stars are so big and the earth is so small. Sometimes when I look into your eyes, the beauty that I see makes me want to cry. The stars are so big and the earth is so
was Country Joe and the Fish. The song's called Magoo. One of the great guardians at the gate appears in Stevenson's Kidnapped. Early in the story, David Balfour has set out in search of his uncle, whom he has never met, but who, he is told, lives in the great house of Shaws. David asks directions and is several times warned away. "Well, Manny," says one person, "it's none of my affairs, but you seem a decent-spoken lad, and if you'll tack a word from me, you'll keep clear of the Shaws." Let's have Davy himself tell us what happened next. "I cannot well describe the blow this dealt to my illusions. The more indistinct the accusations were, the less I liked them, for they left the wider field to fancy. What kind of a great house was this that all the parish should start and stare and be asked the way to it? What sort of gentleman that his ill fame should thus be current at the wayside? If an hour's walking would have brought me back home, I had left my adventure then and there. But when I had come so far away already, mere shame would not suffer me to desist till I had put the matter to the touch of proof. I was bound, out of mere self-respect, to carry it through. And little as I liked the sound of what I heard, and slow as I began to travel, I still kept asking my way and still kept advancing. It was drawing on to sundown when I met a stout, dark, sour-looking woman come trudging down the hill, and she, when I had put my usual question, turned sharp about, accompanied me back to the summit she had just left, and pointed to a great bulk of building standing very bare upon a green in the bottom of the next valley. The country was pleasant round about, running in low hills, pleasantly watered and wooded, and the crops, to my eyes, wonderfully good. But the house itself appeared to be a kind of ruin. No road led up to it, no smoke arose from any of the chimneys, nor was there any semblance of a garden. My heart sank. 'That?' I cried. The woman's face lit up with a malignant anger. 'That is the house of Shaws,' she cried. 'Blood built it. Blood stopped the building of it. Blood shall bring it down. See here,' she cried again, 'I spit upon the ground and crack my thumb at it. Black be its fall. If ye see the laird, Tell him what you hear. Tell him that this makes the 1,219th time that Janet Clouston has called Doon the curse on him and his house, buyer and stable, man, guest and maester, wife, miss or bairn, black be their fall. And the woman, whose voice had risen to a kind of eldritch sing-song, turned with a